Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Telerik. Create compelling app experiences across any screen with the Telerik platform. Telerik's end-to-end platform uniquely combines industry-leading UI tools with cloud services to simplify the entire app development cycle. Telerik offers everything .NET developers need to build quality apps faster. Try it free at telerik.com/platform. That's telerik.com/platform.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 447. In this episode, Scott talks with musician, artist, and inventor Moldover about exploring new frontiers in electronic music.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm talking with Moldover, who is a musician, an artist, and an inventor from the Bay Area, who I met over in Stockholm, Sweden. How's it going?
Hey, Scott. It's going well. Good to be here.
I really appreciate you chatting with me today. You've got a really, really diverse background. You got a lot of stuff going on, but I wanted to talk to you about this idea of controllerism and explain to people who have never heard that word before. What does that mean, controllerism?
Well, that's the word I started using back in 2007 when I was performing with a laptop and a sort of hacked up keyboard MIDI controller. And it was just challenging to kind of explain what I was doing because I had a lot of custom software. I had this very customized physical interface, and the music I was doing was I'd like to think, kind of ahead of its time. So, you know, you can either use an older way to describe that, like I'm doing live electronic music or something like that. But I thought a new word was just kind of a neat way to pique people's interest. And the word I came up with to explain it seemed to do a pretty good job because there's a lot of understanding. Like DJ culture had become very mainstream and everybody knows. Yeah, I knew at that time what DJs do, and the extension of that is turntablism, was also super popular. So just kind of capitalizing on that popular understanding of a term to coin a new term seemed like a great idea. So I went for it.
Would you not in any way to discount or say that turntablism is somehow less skillful, but when I saw you perform, I got the impression that you were doing a lot of work. There was, you know what I mean? I didn't feel like it was, a lot of work was done ahead of time. Well, when I watch a DJ and a turntable, I get a sense that perhaps they put together the gig and they're kind of there with their gig as opposed to they are the gig and they brought the gig with them.
Yeah. Well, the performances I'm doing now are a little removed from that. I've picked up the guitar again since and started writing songs since. So my performance style has changed from what it was, when I coined that term. But yeah, it's true. What I was doing then, just like what I was doing now, was much more technically complex than what DJs or turntablists do. It was really more about just like, reaching an audience and also like encouraging other people to do the same thing, because every time I would do a workshop or sit down with a friend who is already a musician or already a DJ and kind of show them the technology I was using, they were just blown away. And if I gave them the opportunity to play it, they just had the most fun, you know, they'd light up like little kids. So a lot of it was just wanting to like spread the ideas and grow the culture and build a community of music makers who, you know, could do the same things that I was doing, just to kind of, you know, just to have people around.
Before this kind of resurgence and excitement around electronic music, what would someone have available to them? If I say today, I'm going to enter the world of electronic music, I just buy a MIDI keyboard and do some sampling, and that's the extent of what I'm able to do?
Well, there's so much crazy stuff now. I mean, computer-based, I got into electronic music right when things were moving quickly from hardware, like hardware rack mount synthesizers or synthesizer sampler keyboards and workstations and stuff like that into computers where everything was kind of like virtual copies of that and then some. So I did not go through a phase of like buying old analog keyboards and, you know, learning how to use a hardware sampler. I had some bits of that gear, but I was much more excited about the stuff that my computer could do. I was really into computers. I had a computer in my home like since growing up, and I learned to program. I was really into games, so I was just really comfortable with the whole computer world. And anyways, geez, we're way past that now. So I mean, the things you can do with a laptop or even like a tablet or a smartphone just far surpass anything I was doing at that time. And it's become incredibly easy to, you know, just connect all these things and make music happen. And I can't even imagine. I'm going to Berklee College of Music next week in Boston, and it'll be really interesting to see what young people who are coming up in electronic music are doing.
Now, why did you feel the need to make physical controllers? Like you said, you can do pretty much everything in software. Why isn't just a regular keyboard enough? What is it about the physicality and the making of your own controller?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something you don't know unless you've practiced a musical instrument or something similar. In practicing and learning a musical instrument, you do a lot of like repetitive kind of things, like learning your scales or whatever. You repeat these motions over and over again with your muscles, with your hands, or with your voice or whatever, and that's what enables virtuosic performance and these really, really interesting and fun states of playing music where you're not cognitively thinking about moving your left index finger from this string to that string to play the next note, but your muscles have been so well trained that the music just kind of flows through you. And having that experience, you know, studying guitar for a long time and a bunch of other instruments, that's what I knew I wanted from a musical instrument. So when I started playing with computers and MIDI controllers, it quickly became apparent that there really weren't any good affordable MIDI controllers to interact with the software that I had, and there wasn't anything. You know, there were some very esoteric, specialized instruments. Like you could get multi-touch services, you know, back in like 2002, but they were super expensive and they were kind of one-trick ponies. You know, you could spend your whole allowance on one of those things and you'd only be able to do one thing. So to me, there was no instrument that came anywhere close to the maturity of what a guitar, a keyboard, or a drum kit is. And so I decided I needed to create that.
Was the Robocaster one of your first? This was your controller/guitar. It was an electric guitar, and you integrated a custom controller inside of that. Was that one of your first? Or
No, the Robocaster guitar is actually one of the most recent. It's a funny thing. I just kind of did a 180. I was playing in a bunch of bands. You know, I was a guitarist. I was leading my own band as a vocalist and guitarist and doing all this much more traditional musician kind of stuff. And I just kind of got fed up with all the drama that can result from being in bands and that kind of situation. And I just left all that. And so I put the guitar away for several years. I actually didn't play for like a long, long time. And was just playing these controllers because it really was a lot of work at the time I was doing it, you know, to make these things behave. There's great software out there, but it wasn't anywhere near as mature as it is now. So you kind of had to roll your own software, so to speak, with these like higher level object oriented languages that we use, like Reactor and Max MSP. You know, they're not exactly like coding, but they're ways that you can design your own software instrument. So, you know, just getting over that hurdle and getting a physical interface to work with that thing and learning all the principles of like instrument design, you know, ergonomics tactile feedback and all that kind of stuff. So I had my hands full with the controllers, and integrating it now with the guitar and with the voice is a more recent development.
I think you may have actually just indirectly answered the next question I was going to ask you, because you just said tactile feedback. And I believe when I saw you in Sweden, you were using the Mojo, or a version of the Mojo, which is the kind of a, it looks like a box with a whole bunch of arcade buttons on it, but it has more than just buttons. It's got sliders and knobs. There's a kineticness to the controller. My question was going to be, why didn't you just use a big iPad? Is it the physicality of the switches that's important?
Yeah, number one is there was no iPad. There was a $3,000 device called a Lemur, which did the multi-touch stuff that iPad does. But I even borrowed one of those and set that up to do the things I was doing with the Mojo. And it just falls flat because there's no tactile feedback. You can't learn it by muscle memory, so you can never get to a virtuoso level of performance. And if you see people performing with an iPad now, you have this kind of same effect that you had back in the laptop days. You know, you'd see people on stage, quote unquote, checking their email, which was kind of the performance aesthetic I was like railing against and trying to change.
I haven't seen a real pro DJ, but I've seen a number of DJs where it's like, really, are you texting right now?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, like DJing is one thing, but you know, seeing what's billed as like a live performance and then it really just being somebody behind a laptop, I found that really frustrating. And you kind of wind up doing the same thing now if you have an iPad, not because of an aesthetic choice or anything, but because the device requires you to look at it so you can see which button your finger's on top of. So it's, you know, the tablets are really useful interfaces for computers and for producing music, all these other musical activities, you know, they're great for, but for like live performance, you know, the actual expression, the connection between human and machine, they're not that great.
So people will be able to go up and look at the show notes and see a picture of the Mojo and also see video of you using it. But one of the things I noticed was it wasn't just a box with some buttons. If I understand from watching you, you had buttons mounted around like a donut around your microphone. I think you might have had foot pedals. You were basically everywhere at all times, different interfaces. How many different pieces are involved in a live performance like that?
Well, the show I'm doing now is only three pieces of gear. So there's the Mojo, which you described really well, that just controls the playback and manipulation of sounds from my computer. So that's kind of like, you know, conducting the orchestra or cueing and arranging the band, if you will. I've got the Robocaster guitar where I play, you know, lead guitar parts and kind of modify those with the controls on the guitar. So that's kind of like actually having the pedal board built into the face of the guitar, which you can do some really interesting things with. And then the thing you're describing that was attached to my microphone, that's a prototype of an instrument I don't have a name for. It's just the microphone controller. And it's growing out of the same world of the Robocaster, where it's like, oh, what can I do to augment? You know, I've learned the guitar really well. Like, what can I do with this kind of controller building idea to augment what I do with guitar? And I'm doing the same thing with voice as well. And so you saw a prototype. This is like a giant clip with a bunch of arcade buttons on it. And the next one is going to look like probably kind of like a trumpet, but smaller.
That's pretty, so it worked really well. I mean, it gave a sense of a modern day one man band. Like you were up there and you're on the tightrope and there's no net. And I think that's the sense of like, what's he going to do next? He could make a mistake. Whoa, did he just do that? As opposed to the, oh, he set this playlist up before he got here.
Yeah, well, that's the key. One of the key elements of live music performance is the risk. There's really nothing live and there's nothing exciting about it for me as a performer or as an audience watching, I think, if there's no possibility of something going wrong. And if nothing goes wrong for an entire show, you know, I feel kind of unsatisfied, because as an audience member for other people's shows, those are my favorite parts, you know, when there's like, you know, the guy gets ready to play and there's nothing's coming out of the microphone, you know, and he has to spend the first 3 minutes of his show, like, you know, troubleshooting something. Those are, you know, in the past I've seen people do that and always been really entertained by it. And people come to me after my shows and are often like, oh man, that was really cool when, like, you know, that one mic stopped working, so you ran over to the mic from the next band and started using that one or whatever. Risk is part of live music. And I build a certain amount of risk. There's a certain amount of control too, you know, because you want to have something you can rely on, some sort of confident structure you can lean back on and know that you'll kind of sound good if you have a cold that night or just had a fight with your girlfriend or whatever. You know, it's cool to not have too much risk.
So it's interesting that you've mentioned risk so much, because then if I understand correctly, and again, I'm in just learning about this world, but the non-risky thing for you to do would be to buy controllers, go to Native Instruments, go to Denon, spend a lot of money, go to Newmark Industries, spend big money, 50, 60 grand worth of equipment, and now you're a person who's bought his Iron Man armor, except you built your Iron Man armor yourself.
Yeah, well, I still buy instruments, you know, like for studio production. I just got a pair of new studio
monitors, regular instruments. Great.
Yeah, yeah, and all kinds of stuff. But is part of my arsenal. But there's something, I don't know. It's kind of this path that I've gone, and it gives a lot of character to my shows. And for a minute, it felt like a novelty thing, you know, and it'd just be like, oh, people would always be talking more about my gear than about my music. But I think it's come around full circle, where I just kind of had to kind of own the technology, figuratively speaking, you know, to where these instruments. You know, I've been playing the Mojo for, I don't know, like 6 years now. So it used to be like, yes, I've played guitar for like 15, and this feels like an extension of my body. But, you know, this box full of buttons and stuff feels a little strange. But now I'm just as comfortable with it. And I think that's the magical part, is when you can have all this wacky technology, things people have likely not seen before. But you can use it in a way that, makes it seem effortless. And, you know, to an observer, it's just kind of magical, you know, humans using tools to extend their creative output.
One of the things that I think is unique about you, and as I've been wandering around doing research and trying to understand what you do and why you do it, is that you're not keeping this to yourself. You're not only giving the music out there, you're putting the music out there, you're putting yourself out there, but you've actually put the design of the Mojo controller and made it open source. People could potentially, if they knew what they were doing, make one.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've benefited so much from information that other people have shared, and that's the thing that makes the internet great. It's a delicate balance. Because you can't just give away, you know, the product of all your labor for free, or how are you going to make a living? But whenever possible, I try to give stuff away. And definitely, you know, when like, I've, you know, if it doesn't have use to me, I see no reason to hide the secret. And really early on, I think I got a good lesson, because even before I came up with the word controllerism, you know, I just had this challenge of like helping audiences and even like, you know, friends and fans like understand the technology I'm using, and having to do that kind of explaining is what drove me to make videos. And I have a lot of YouTube content, and people more frequently are like, oh, I've seen your videos, than, oh, I heard your record. And they're not talking about music videos. They're talking about some weird video where I'm like, hey, let's check out these instruments I invented. Here's how I made them. Here's a website where you can download all the plans. You know, here, watch me make one, and super fast forward time lapse. So, you know, I like doing that stuff. I think it combines, what I think is one of the most noble professions, which is teaching. Which is a very, you know, humanitarian, like serving others kind of thing, with something that can feel a little more self-serving, which is performing and composing and being a solo artist.
Yeah, this definitely seems like the kind of stuff that I would want to see at Maker Faire. You know, I was just at the Maker Faire here in Portland with my kids, and all of your stuff, all your projects fit right in.
Yeah, Maker Faire is amazing. I've been to the Bay Area one a few times, and I was in New York Maker Faire 2 years ago, and that's a really great culture. I love that, and I support it whenever I can.
So just last year, you had a successful Kickstarter, and you're working on that while you're gigging and doing your million other things that you're doing. The thing that's so great about your Kickstarter that really caught my eye is that it's a circuit board instrument that is effectively in the package of a tape. Of like a tape deck, a cassette. It's like a cassette tape. It's like Awesome Mix Number One. It's Guardians of the Galaxy. It's this amazing instrument, all in the size of, you know, credit card sized.
Yeah, well, I did the, it's kind of a second iteration of an album artwork idea that I executed with my last album. It was my last album I actually put out physical media. It was on CD. I got this idea from a friend who had made business cards out of circuit boards to make CD artwork out of circuit boards. So I did that and it was virally successful. I got, hundreds of thousands of hits on this video and sold, way, way more, super deluxe circuit board albums than I ever thought I would. So the idea was to kind of repeat that success in kind of a more controlled way with the Kickstarter. And the cassette seemed like a natural kind of like next step. What is great about the cassette is as far as like a small portable, artifact, like, I mean, there's no cassette in there, but there's a cassette case and you see that cassette case and you know it's music. And that's one of the challenges if you're still trying to produce physical artifacts for music, for releasing music like I am, there's this question of like, does a USB stick really, carry the weight and the message of like, I am an awesome music artifact, even like a customized USB stick. So this is there's a USB stick like on it. It kind of is a custom USB stick, but it's a little bit fancier than that. It's a musical instrument. So
it's called the Voice Crusher.
The Voice Crusher, yes. It's got a microphone and a speaker, so you can use it battery powered, and it's got a really low fidelity pitch shifter built into it. And I circuit bent that in a bunch of different ways so you can kind of mangle your voice into these distorted and shifted and modulated 8-bit weird sounds. That's where the crusher comes from. It's not a pretty sounding kind of thing, but it's really fun.
Did you make this yourself? I mean, are you such a skilled, not only software, you said you can do programming, you're a musician, you also have hardware skills? Because I see pictures of prototypes, it's like you had some mentorship from a friend to put this together.
Yeah, this is me like inching a little closer to being, like a super low level electrical engineer. So I had mentorship from somebody who is a proper electrical engineer, and I'd basically do a bunch of work and take it to him, ask a bunch of questions, and then move on. So that is really the first thing. I mean, I made all these things, but they were all built, with like, oh, well, it's a MIDI controller kit. They give you the microcontroller and you can just attach sensors to it. And that's kind of how Arduino and a lot of these platforms work, is you don't really have to know programming. You don't really have to know electrical engineering. You can just learn enough to make the thing go. But in this case, besides the actual pitch shifting circuit, which is an integrated circuit, all the other stuff was me figuring it out, learning how to make analog filters and hack circuits in interesting and playable ways. And and this is the first manufacturing project too. So I'm working with this Chinese manufacturer and learning how that wacky process works.
It's a lot more complicated than people realize. I think that folks get the wrong idea about Kickstarter. They think it's a store. They think they bought something and they bought a widget and they want you to see, where's my widget? You didn't send me my widget in time. But this is almost a donation with a prize if you were right about who you donated it to.
Yeah, that's how I think of it. I mean, it's kind of weird wielding the Kickstarter campaign power, right? Because all these people have donated or pledged, or there's all these different words you can use for what the form of that money is, and many of them are expecting very different things. I think I've done a really good job of sort of like combining things that people really want, and most of the people that pledged the campaign are existing fans of mine and people that have been following my work for a while, and I think they can totally appreciate that I'm not an electrical engineer and I haven't worked with a Chinese manufacturer before. So when you read all the updates and you see the that little odyssey, as well as I'm producing a music album and just paying the bills with other gigs on the side, people are very sympathetic and understanding, I think, and I'm glad you bring that up about Kickstarter. That's not a store.
Well, certainly people can go up and they can look on your site, they can hit buy, they can see your debut album, which was the Circuit Board CD 2008, which is really, really cool. It's a nice etched CD in a case, which itself has circuits. It's a piece of art in itself before you even play it, which is really cool. Because like you said, people aren't necessarily saying, hey, I heard your album. They're saying, hey, I saw you gig. there's a visual, very visual aspect to what you're doing. They can also, of course, pre-order the, you know, four track and the Voice Crusher, but it's not done yet. You know, this is going to take some time to put these things together.
Yeah, they take time, but they're coming along great, and I'm expecting to have the album finished by the end of the year.
Very, very cool. Now, do you spend a lot of time, like, and forgive my ignorance, like soldering and tinkering and just trying to figure out how to make things sound right? Or, you know, how do you go about how you separate your time as far as like you, there has to be time to tinker and be creative, but then you got a gig and, you know, pay the rent?
Yeah, well, it's an ever challenging thing. Time management is a whole topic when I do like a workshop, and I have a lot of strategies, involves lots of lists and reminders popping up on my phone, and different techniques for dealing with the world. Right now I have a sticky in front of me that I made about a week ago, because I was in Europe for 3 weeks and I was in Burning Man for a week, and trying to get like really, really focused on the album again, takes a lot of discipline. So this is just a list of like, you know, put the phone in airplane mode, get it away from me, don't touch the internet until like, you know, 3 p.m. Yeah, when responding to messages and email, like, it's okay to delete them if they don't require a response. Yes.
It is okay to say no.
It's okay to be brief. So yeah, it's an ever challenging thing. But it keeps life really interesting, and my days are a lot more pleasurable when I spend like, you know, some time in front of the computer doing something, you know, like more mouse and keyboard, and I spend some time with instruments and singing, and then I spend some time in the workshop tinkering. Like, you know, I love all these things, and being able to do them all every day usually makes me happiest.
Where would you send someone who's maybe a child, or if I know you do workshops and you've taught, you also do private tutoring and things like that on Skype, but if you have a kid who's interested in music, do you send them to download some software to go get like Ableton Live or something like that? Or where's step zero for someone who's interested in getting involved in this kind of a community?
It's a great idea. I mean, I know a lot of people who do it successfully as you're suggesting, through the internet, like downloading some software, looking at video tutorials and getting on forums and stuff to ask questions. So that's definitely what I tell people. I get a lot of people who discover me through the internet. So there are people all around the world. And so that's the kind of ground, the starting point that I give those people.
Is there a particular piece of software? Like I, as a podcaster, I can say, go get Audacity, pick up a $30 mic and try it out. You know, I have $100 and I want to start to learn about controllerism and I want to learn about electronic music. And where's that step, that first step?
Yeah, I recommend Ableton because that's what got me into it. You know, it was the first version of Ableton in 2001, 2002 that... I was using plenty of other software before that, but my favorite tool was one called Sonic Foundry Acid that was actually very similar to the first version of Ableton, and I think you probably even inspired a lot of what Ableton is. So, you know, I found that tool, and Ableton's gotten a lot more complex, actually. That's something I can't appreciate is, you know, after 9 revisions, you know, it's got a zillion more features, and it's not quite the little like one trick pony it used to be, but it's a very powerful and very, it's really powerful, but it's just, there's nothing else comparable to it as far as like ease of use and immediacy. And the fact that it's called Live, I think is great because, they've stayed true to that word and they've kept it a very real time application, and they've kept lots of features in it that make it good for performance. And there's no other piece of music software that's as mature as that, that started as a live music performance instrument. So it's pretty unique like that.
Do your controllers interface with these applications, or are they self-contained? Are you pushing buttons and telling your computer to do something, or are you manipulating the sound in the controller itself?
The controllers are all pretty dumb, so to speak. They're just sending out MIDI over USB to the computer, and anything fancy happens inside the computer.
Cool. So people can go up to moldover.com. They can check out your store. They can see your videos. You're all over YouTube. You're all talked about on Wikipedia as well. It's pretty cool.
Where am I on Wikipedia? Oh, in the controllerism.
In the controllerism and terminal turntablism, you're referenced. It's cool to be referenced on Wikipedia.
Yeah, I need to get my own page.
Yeah, you do. It's a crime, man. I don't know. They deleted mine. I'm not notable.
deleted it?
I have a whole, there's a whole discussion. They're like, yeah, he's just, he's done, haven't done enough stuff.
Enough stuff. Okay.
You got to do more stuff. Get that second album and then it'll be, you know, how many albums do you have?
Of original music, just the one.
Which people can get on Amazon, MP3 digital download.
Yeah, that one is absolutely everywhere. And the follow-up is coming soon.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Yeah, my pleasure. This is super fun, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.